which worked in this scenario, but I think sometimes as Christians in America today, we think, if I can just get him to the pastor will tell him about Jesus. If I can just get the kid to VBS, the VBS teachers will tell them all they need to know about God. And we kind of leave some of that responsibility on off of ourselves if you know, someone who's better at it can do it. And really, that's a broken model, I think. If you look at the New Testament, it's written to equip us as believers to be able to do this ourselves without having to rely on a pastor to do it. Because you never know, you could get the fill-in pastor and he could suck. So that was me, not other people. But anyway, that's how it works here. I don't think that that's the model for New Testament, but we can learn about some of the steps that these people took and how that can help us with evangelism. I want to start by making the point that, you know, this is what we're supposed to be doing as Christians. This is part of, not the entirety of, but part of the Christian life. In Acts chapter 1, 6 through 9, Jesus is about to be beamed up back to heaven after raising from the dead. And the disciples gather around him and they ask, "Lord, are you going at this time, are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel?" He said, "It's not for you to know the times or the dates the Father has set by his own authority, but you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes on you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in all Judea and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth." So if you think about a map that starts right here in your area, then a little farther out, and then to the whole earth. So my point here is we're supposed to be doing these things as Christians. And so we'll start in 2 Kings 5. We're going to just take it a couple of verses at a time. Maybe it'll build some drama towards the end. But we start off with Naaman was the army commander of the king of Aram. He was very important to his master, the king, and was highly respected. That's because the Lord had helped him win the battle over Aram's enemies. He was a brave soldier, but he had a skin disease. So the skin disease, I'm going with the New International Reader's Version for this. It's designed for people who are first learning how to read, but especially when I read the Old Testament and the these and the thous, and it just, I like this one. I think it's a lot clearer. And that's also what we used with the kids downstairs. So most translations translate skin disease as leprosy. But if you look at Leviticus 13 and 14 and the places where it talks about the laws of what you're supposed to do if you might have leprosy and the priests just to examine you and all this stuff, it's pretty clear that leprosy, what they meant back then, is not the one disease that we call leprosy today. So I like the translation of skin disease. And honestly, I didn't look too much into it, but Israelite culture had a very negative connotation towards skin diseases. And you had to stay outside the camp for a while and all this stuff. It seems like it was there in other cultures too, but maybe just not quite to the full extent that it was in Israeli culture. But either way, this guy, he's got this skin disease, and either because of the stigma or just the physical uncomfortableness of it, he wanted it gone. And so we made it one verse with the kids before they asked the question that I was not expecting. Two of them, they really wanted to know, why did he have a skin disease, and how gross is it? And so I imagine it's pretty gross. I don't know. But why he had a skin disease, honestly, I think he probably touched something gross or didn't shower enough. But a lot of times when we start thinking about why does people have a skin disease or whatever is wrong with them, we sometimes go to God gave it to them as punishment, which may be true sometimes. But I think we, and by we, I'm going to admit me sometimes, think, okay, God gave that to him as punishment, so that kind of lets me off the hook of helping. And I think that's an attitude that we kind of need to get rid of. But moving on, verse 2, groups of soldiers from Aram had marched out, previously marched out, and they had captured a young girl from Israel. She became the servant of Naaman's wife. And so here we talked with the kids a little bit about Naaman, and what it says is a group of soldiers, I assume under Naaman's command, they go out, they defeat Israel in a battle, and apparently they take some people back to be slaves. One of them, a little girl, it says, comes back and becomes basically a servant in Naaman's household, like a slave working for his wife. So You know, if we're going to try to relate to the Bible passage here, what is our thought about Naaman at this time? I think he kind of sounds like a jerk, going out stealing people and making little kids work for his wife. That's not a good thing to do. That's not nice. And the kids thought he sounded like a jerk as well. They immediately went to some kid in their class. His name's not Henry, but we'll call him Henry, in case you guys know his mom or something. But they started talking about, Henry's a jerk, Henry's this, Henry's that. And that makes, I think that that's a good thing to do. That's what we should do with the Bible, is say, okay, how is this similar to my life? And so the kind of question I want to ask ourselves today is, who is our Henry in our life? Who is the Naaman? Who is the guy who wrongs us, who drives us nuts, who annoys the crap out of you? You know, who's someone that doesn't deserve your kindness? And then we can also take that down a notch, and maybe it's not, you know, the person who always drives us nuts, but maybe it's the person who drives us nuts today. And it's 9:20 in the morning, so chances are the first person that's only had the chance to drive you nuts today is your spouse or your kids, right? So we can take this, and the person that always drives us nuts, you know, like the boss, Trump, Obama, coworker, friend that just always gets you. We can think about it that way. We can also think about it as the person who's doing this to me right now. And am I going to treat them the way that they need? And then we can also look at it as ourselves. Sometimes we're Naaman to ourselves. Sometimes we make ourselves mad. Something that we probably don't consider enough is that when other people make their list of Naamans, maybe we might be on it. I think if you ever want to really think deeply about yourself and the way you carry yourself, The Trouble with X is a essay by C.S. Lewis. You can find it like an audio version online and probably a written version too. Be a pretty good thing to take a listen to. It's pretty convicting. But, you know, let's think about these people in our life who are driving us nuts, either consistently or just at this very moment, and what is our attitude towards them? And does it match this little girl's? Because in 2 Kings 5:3, the girl spoke to the woman she was serving. She said, I wish my master, Naaman, would go and see the prophet who is in Samaria. He would heal my master of his skin disease. Her attitude is, I'm going to help him. Maybe not I want to help him. Maybe it's not there yet, but I'm going to want to help. I'm going to try to help him. And so that person that always makes us mad, do we just want to sit in our madness and be angry at them? Or are we willing to help them anyway, even though they may not deserve it? And I think that's even more true in that temporary spot. Like, when your wife really makes you mad, assuming that that happens, sorry, are we willing to meet them where they're at and help them a little bit, or are we just going to stew in our madness? Because I think when we talk about helping people as Christians, we are, oh yeah, evangelism, we got to help them know that Jesus paid for their sins. But there's also the everyday life, the Christian walk, and just, you know, regular life, that we have responsibility to help people too. And so Danielle read the verse about being at peace with all men when we started, and I got a couple here. Matthew 5:44, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. We got Matthew 5:12, this is my commandment, that you love one another just as I loved you. Deuteronomy 22:4, if you see that your neighbor's donkey or ox has collapsed on the road, do not look the other way. Go and help your neighbor get it back on its feet. Did you guys notice what's missing from every one of those verses? The part where it says you don't have to do it unless they deserve it. That's not in any of those, right? It's not pray for your enemies and those who persecute you as long as they stop, or as long as you think they might stop. It's not love one another just as I have loved you once you see that they're deserving of it. And Deuteronomy 22:4, if you look at where he's going through these same kind of laws in Exodus, he takes this law and he applies it to your enemy. If your enemy's neighbor loses his donkey, you have to help him get it back, or at least you're supposed to. And so, like, it not only applies to people that we want to help, but people that we don't want to help. And, you know, that can be frustrating. I get it. People generally are dumb and suck, and sometimes they're mean. But that doesn't excuse us from our responsibility to help them. And, you know, I was reading something about this, and the point was, like, we should care about them like Jesus cares about them. You know, it's a lot easier to treat people the right way if you have that care for them, even though they don't deserve it. But it's really hard to care for people who are jerks. And the thing I read made a good point of, if you don't care about them like you should, maybe try treating them like you would if you did care about them. And I'll be honest, I think that's a frustrating thing to do. But I think it's also a spiritually good thing to do. And this is a battle that Jesus repeatedly had with the Pharisees when he was on earth, where he would go hang out with people and they'd be like, don't you know what she does on the weekends? And that kind of stuff. A main example is in Matthew 9, when he calls Matthew a tax collector, which is like one of the worst sinners you could be back in that day, at least in the eyes of the Pharisees. And he says, Matthew, come with me, and Matthew does, and then he goes has dinner at Matthew's house, and the Pharisees come up with him, and they're like, hey, dude, why are you eating with all these terrible sinners? Don't you know how bad they are? And he says to them, it's not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire compassion and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. So my main point here is that this girl wasn't concerned with whether or not Naaman was worthy of her help. She just gave it to him anyway. And, like, I'll be honest, you know, if the Russians or whatever ever come and take me prisoner, I'm not just going to, like, you know, help them cook their supper nicely or whatever. I am inspired when I read, like, World War II stories of people in concentration camps who, like, slowly undermine the Nazis with what they were trying to do. I'd like to think I'd be that guy. I'd probably just cry in the corner, if I'm being honest with myself. But I'm also inspired. There's a lot of stories, especially with the women, who were in Papua New Guinea when the Japanese took over. Or, I don't know, other places where the Nazis and the Japanese took over. And while they didn't say, yes, this is great, I love the Nazis, they still, the way that they treated, even up to their commanders of their prisoner camp, had an impact and even evangelized some of the leaders of those camps. And so I think that's, you know, kind of an inspiring thing. But, like, if they can do it to the Nazis, maybe I can do it to my brother. Sorry. You know what I mean? So maybe we can be a little bit better at that as Christians. And so then we move on, and okay, so first point, the witness to Naaman was a team effort. First person that took part in that was a little girl, because she cared about him, even though he might not have deserved it. Then Naaman goes and says, hey, that's a good idea, I'm going to go to the king. And in verse 5, the king says, I think you should go. I'll give you a letter, you can take it to the king of Israel. So Naaman left and took a bunch of silver and a bunch of gold and 10 sets of clothes. Like, really, if you're going to bring me 750 pounds of silver and 150 pounds of gold, you can really leave the clothes at home. I'll be okay. But apparently he thought that was worth bringing. But anyway, I mean, I had 3 guys on the list. We really could have had 4. I guess the king of Aram kind of helped him on his journey. And just a quick thing to think about is, when our friends, spouses, kids, whatever, are trying to have a better relationship with God, to do the Christian life better, that kind of stuff, are we the kind of guy that says, I think you should go? Or do we kind of hold them back? Or do we say, I think you should go, but then maybe our actions don't help them go so much? But anyway, we go to the king of Israel, and the letter said, I'm sending my servant to you with this letter. I want you to heal him of his skin disease. The king of Israel reads that and says, am I God? Can I kill people and bring them back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be healed of his skin disease? He must be trying to pick a fight with me. And that's all after he tore his royal robes. It's a cultural thing, I guess, back in the Old Testament to tear your clothes and throw dust on your head when you're sad. maybe if I'm in that culture, it wouldn't annoy me, but I would get really annoyed with the dramatics of it all. Like, just leave your clothes on, be sad that way. So here we, you know, the king did nothing. And he had a chance, you know, and like, we can't help everybody. The king thinks this is an excuse for the king of Aram to start a war with him. And like, we really can't help everybody. But we can sometimes, even if we're not the guy to do the helping, lead them to someone who can, or just pray for them, or even just pat them on the back and say, hey, that really sucks, I'm sorry. But like, sometimes I think we have this blurred lines between, you know, I don't think that God really wants me to step in here, or I don't really have the ability to do that. And we kind of blur those lines with, I don't want to do that. So it is a legitimate thing sometimes just to be like, hey, this is not the thing that I need to be doing. This is not the way that I'm supposed to help somebody at this time, and to take a step back. But let's be sure that we're doing that because that's what is actually true, and not just that we don't want to do it. You know, the king could have sent him to Elisha. And it would have gone poorly if the king would have tried to heal his skin disease. That's not his area. But he just kind of freaked out and didn't do anything, as opposed to actually considering if he could help in the situation. And Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, so he sent the king a message. He said, dude, why did you tear your robes? Just send them to me. Then he will know that there's a prophet in Israel. So Naaman went to see Elisha. He took his horses and chariots, and he stopped at the door of Elisha's house. And then Elisha sent a messenger out to him. The messenger said, go, wash yourself in the Jordan River 7 times, then your skin will be healed, and you will be pure and clean again. So let's take a minute and relate to Elisha in this situation. What is Elisha's goal in this encounter? Naaman to know that there's a prophet in Israel. Not so that he can say, hey, I'm the prophet in Israel, but so that Naaman can know the truth about God. And the way that Elisha goes about this is kind of interesting. He doesn't even go out of his house to meet Naaman, and he just sends a messenger out there, and he doesn't accept his gold, he doesn't do all that. And he does this because he knows where Naaman's at. Naaman is looking for somebody to do the healing when he should be looking for God to do the healing. And if Elisha goes out there and says, hey, I'm here, I'll heal you, then all Naaman's affection for, I don't know, but whatever, goes on Elisha and not on God. And so it doesn't mean that we should always just like hide in our house and send a messenger out to help people. But the point is, he met Naaman where he was at spiritually, and that helped him with his evangelism of him. You know, and that's one thing that Jesus was really good at. If you watch people come up to Jesus, he has a lot of different responses to similar questions because he understands what that person is at and where they need to know. You know, like sometimes he lets people come up and worship him and like cry on his feet and dump perfume on his head and all those kind of things. But then some guy comes up to him and calls him good teacher, and he's like, whoa, why are you calling me good? Only God's good. Because if you read the rest of that interaction, that guy had in his mind that he was also good. And Jesus needed to kind of dispel him of that. And so meeting people where they're at is a good thing. Not that we're uncompromising on truth, but we're not, you know, going to go out there, hey, you're a dirty, rotten sinner because you do this, this, and this. Sometimes people need that swift kick, and that's what some people need. Some people just need the truth about forgiveness, and they just need maybe some love, like the little girl gave him. But really, what happens here is Elisha finishes the witness. The little girl got Naaman started towards God, and Elisha kind of finishes it off. He doesn't follow Naaman around and be like, hey, have you made your decision yet? Do you know about it? Have you accepted it? But he gives him the words that he needs to have. Whereas the little girl really didn't say much about God. She just said, hey, there, you should go here to get healed. And I think that's something to remember also when we're talking about people, trying to help them, whether we're trying to help them know that Jesus paid for their sins, or just help them get out of a tough spot spiritually, or help them stay in a good spot spiritually, is we all have roles in this, and the roles are going to be probably different from person to person and situation to situation. I know I've used this analogy before. I don't know if it was like up here to you guys, so I'm sorry if it's a repeat. But when I think about this and telling people about God and stuff, I kind of think of like farming. You start with working the ground, and then if you really think about everybody that has a hand in the harvest, clearly the guy running the combine, that's the first person you think about, or the guy delivering the grain, he gets it too. But if you really think about everybody that's in there, from the guy that worked the ground, to planted, to your seed guy selling you Pioneer with science with service, delivering success. Matt, you owe me $13 for that one. There's lots of people in that process. And sometimes there's lots of people in the process of helping people either come to God or stay with God or know more, or in their walk. And the guy who worked the ground has a part in it, just like the guy who actually does the harvest. And so, sometimes you got a Naaman in your life, and he's just tough, and he's compacted, and he doesn't want nothing to do with God, and just by showing him that love, maybe you just run a chisel plow over his life and loosen things up just a little bit and make way for the next guy to have another impact, and then someone else have an impact. We don't have to deliver the whole package all the time. Be ready to deliver the whole package, and if it's there, do it. But sometimes there's roles in this, and it's sometimes it's good to know your role. So the little girl had her point. The king had his time. He really didn't do anything, but he could have had a little role in it. And then Elisha, he kind of finished the witness. So then I kind of want to transition a little bit and start thinking about Naaman, because eventually he does get to the point where he says, "Now I know that there is no God anywhere in the whole world except in Israel." And so it worked. They get him to that point where he knows what he needs to know from this. But let's back up before Naaman gets there and try to relate to him in this situation for a minute. In verse 11, Elisha's messenger just tells him what to do. He goes away angry. He says, "I was sure Elisha would come out to me. I thought he would stand there and pray to the Lord his God. I thought he would wave his hand over my skin, and then I would be healed. And what about the rivers of Damascus? Aren't they better than the rivers of Israel? Couldn't I wash in those rivers and be made pure and clean?" So he turned and went away. He was very angry. And so this is where I started to talk with the kids about people not believing what God has to say. And before I could get into that, they started talking about things that people in their families don't believe, or that they do believe. One, we have a family who extended in the family a little bit. It's not mom and dad or anything, but they are flat earthers. They do not believe that the Bible or that the world is round. Thought that was really a weird take on something that you get out of 2 Kings 5. We also have same guy. Is a moon conspiracy faking guy. So didn't actually land on the moon. It's just a big conspiracy. But I thought that was kind of fun. I then proceeded to waste like an hour of my life looking up flat earth conspiracy stuff because it got me interested. Apparently Antarctica is around the outside and it's 200 feet high and that keeps you from going off, but NASA guards it so that you don't find out. And it's a whole big thing. But we also wasted some time with the kids talking about it. But not believing things is something that we do as Christians. And if you keep reading, Naaman's servants help him out here. They say, "You're like a father to us. What if Elisha the prophet had told you to do some great thing? Wouldn't you have done it? But he only said, 'Wash yourself, then you'll be pure and clean.' You should really be more willing to do that." Naaman went down to the Jordan River finally. He dipped himself in it 7 times. He did exactly what the man of God had told him to do. Then his skin was made pure again. It became clean like the skin of a young boy. And so, you know, what Naaman had a problem with was kind of twofold. He had an expectation of the way things would go, and he also just thought, this sounds way too easy. There should be more to it. There should be a ceremony or like a calling down of something from heaven to clean him and that kind of stuff. And so, you know, if you are a person who's not sure if you're going to heaven, this fits very well here because it's very simple. And sometimes the simpleness of it makes people say, what? Like, if you believe Jesus paid for your sins, spot in heaven is guaranteed. That's the message of the Bible. That is the simplicity of it. All it is believing that. So, if, you know, if you're not in that place, talk to me afterwards. Talk to your neighbor sitting next to you afterwards. But come there. Think about that decision. And it's really easy. Easier than what it maybe easier than we maybe feel like it should be. But also for those of us that already do know that and who already are Christians, maybe we should take God's promise and live in that forgiveness a little bit. You know, God made it easy so we shouldn't make it hard on ourselves when we sin and beat ourselves up over it and that kind of stuff. But also we shouldn't beat each other up over it when each other sin. And, you know, as we go through this, the prophet says, Elisha says, I serve the Lord, and Naaman says, can I please pay you? And Elisha says, no, I'm not going to take anything from you. And Naaman says, okay, fine, but I'm going to take some dirt. I'm going to build an altar to God, and he's the only thing I'm going to serve anymore when I get back to my country. But he says, but every once in a while, the king's going to make me go to the temple with him, and he's going to need my help to bow down and pray to that god, and so I might have to actually bow down next to this idol of this guy, Rimmon. I hope the Lord will forgive me for that. And Elisha says, go in peace. Nothing else. That's probably a bad thing to bow down in the altar of this other god, but Elisha tells him to go in peace. And so I think that is something that's important, is we should go through our lives in peace. The sins are forgiven. If we screw up, it's not good, but it is forgiven. You know, even when Christmas story, the angels come down and peace on earth, goodwill towards men, that's the whole point, is that we should be living in that peace. And as we do live in that peace, then the talking part and the living and at peace with people who are around us, even though they don't deserve it, that can kind of become easier if we live in the peace that God's prepared for us that way. So we should be living at peace with people, peace with ourselves, peace with God, peace with the Naamans of the world. And like that's what the little girl did. She found peace with Naaman, even though she didn't deserve it. Even though maybe she was looking for an opportunity to get out of there and quit being a slave, she still had peace with Naaman. And sometimes having peace with people means just showing them the love of God like that girl did. Sometimes it means, that is not the right slide. Anyway, sometimes it means being like Elisha and actually being the guy that kind of helps them in the later stages of their spiritual journey. And sometimes it means just being there for your fellow Christians and helping them with what they're going through. And then, you know, back to kind of Naaman, just God's laid out some peace for us, and it's really nice to be able to walk in that peace, and it helps us be at peace with others. Go ahead and pray. God, thank you that you laid out that peace for us, and it's hard because we want to show that peace to other people, and sometimes they make it difficult. Sometimes we make it difficult. But help work on our hearts so that we can see the things that you want to work through us and take part in them. And, you know, just help us to do the hard things and help us to know and see the opportunities to do those things. Amen. So just want to give a couple of announcements of my own before anybody else does.